Strangely, I'm doing the sermon that's actually advertised today. I don't know what happened. Marxism, Groucho and Karl. Well, they had some things in common beside the family name. One was somebody who spread anarchy wherever he went. The other was somebody that thought that the universe was essentially an orderly place, that the world would come to its senses, and that there was an almost preordained, though not religiously preordained, historically preordained pattern to history. One was a grouch with problems of personal hygiene, familial relations, and not an awful lot of friends. The other was an anarchist with lots of friends, almost as many wives, and got along pretty well despite some sharp edges. Karl thought that history would play out bloodily but predictably. Groucho knew better. I'm with Groucho. Where Karl made his most fundamental mistake, in my view, was in his belief that the most important indicator of what a society would be and become was who owned the means of production. The capitalists and owners of factories exploiting workers, taking the surplus profit away from workers, would lead inevitably to certain social steps. The contradictions would create tensions, which would create revolutions, and things would play out in a messy, but over geological time, orderly kind of manner. I think he is fundamentally wrong about the means of production's ownership being the critical issue. I believe it is the means of production themselves. It is the technology. It is how we live and with what animals or machines or computers we live that is the most important criterion in how our lives play out and what society looks like and what our values are. Owning the machines, capitalists do exploit workers, but the machines determine, and I use machines in a very broad sense, the shape of a society, the metaphors of how we see ourselves, and to a very large extent, our values and our mores. Now, we have at least one expert in this field here, Jim Fike, who can tell you about what Gutenberg did to Western civilization. The change from just copying texts as badly as people copied texts with all of the mistakes, with all the time it took, that kept manuscripts private and in Latin, back to the Latin and to the Spanish, to Gutenberg's movable type. And what that did to rock the West, it brought books to people, to the masses. And books brought literacy, and it brought thought. People who had been told what the Bible said, very much like in some parts of the world, people who are told what the Quran says, all of a sudden had the ability to look at the Bible and say, what are you talking about? That's not in here. How did you come up with this? It put power in the form of knowledge into the hands of people. It created the Reformation. It created in a way of translating the Bible, not just making it popular in Latin, but translating it into the Vulgate, into all of the various local languages. It created nationhood. It created nationalism. For good or ill, it changed the history of the West and the history of the world. Who owned the press was not as important as we moved from chiseling cuneiform into writing on papyrus, into writing on paper, into printing and having it available to the masses. That one technological change I think, despite what Mel Brooks said in The 2,000-Year-Old Man, is more important than saran wrap. And I hate to argue with Mel Brooks, but saran wrap is only the second most important discovery. That and the thermos, because it keeps hot things hot, cold things cold, and how does it know the difference? Just one of those mysteries of the ages. When we look at the technologies, at societies, we see that what we have determines our values. When we lived, we historically, not we necessarily permanently or personally, in agrarian societies, when hunter-gatherers settled down and planted farms, domesticated animals, and domesticated crops, there was a change in governance from the nomadic to the settled. There was a change in how human beings saw ourselves. In agrarian societies, we tend to make divinities of the forces of nature, and we serve as supplicants to those mighty forces of nature. How we live makes us see ourselves and see our gods according to those objective conditions that we live in. When next to our farms, villages started to be created, again, there's a change. People live by a solar calendar, not by, certainly not on a calendar on the watch, but they lived by times to sow and times to reap, by seasons of flood and seasons of drought. We were tied to the earth's calendar, and that created ways that we lived together. And tribes became families and extended families as houses were built and villages slowly evolved into cities. And with another change of technology, with the Industrial Revolution, we started to see ourselves differently. We started to see our arms as levers as machines were built. We saw food now as fuel that gave us power and energy. Our cities and our factories changed the nature of our metaphor and changed the nature of how we saw time. Because time was no longer, well, the sun's about there, I guess I got a couple of hours to do something. It was, just a second, there's a factory. And the factory and the furnace created a shared public time. It mandated that the watch be created and refined. It mandated that we figure out how to show up at the factory on time. It mandated that those cottages and those people in cottages would migrate to cities with all of the problems that cities have in concentration of people, concentration of talent, and concentration of effluent. All of the challenges then demanded a cycle of invention and of innovation and of values. Power, as well as metaphor, shifted from the tribe to the family to the employer to the owner to the boss. Children, relationships with their families changed because people were gone all day in a city. And children, in the beginning, of course, were brought into factories to work. And their lives changed, their values changed, the lines of power from family elders to family to a greater society changed almost everything. And then you get more inventions. You get the invention of the car, which leads inevitably to the invention of the suburb. And cities change as people move out of these concentrations of population. And the cities are changed and become places eventually for the very rich and the very poor as suburbs are planted out at the edge of the practical commute. And again, values change. The car leads to mobility. The car leads to the motel. The motel leads to problems. Now, the motel didn't invent adultery, I don't think. Classmates.com doesn't really sell it as its main product. It's only a secondary product. But that's an example of how that technology changes actions and mores and the ways that we live. The suburbs create a difference in family, so that the extended family, the people living together, not necessarily in a romantic vision, in tenements and in apartments where families came over from various old countries and lived together and knew each other well, all of a sudden we have this unstable nuclear family out in the suburbs, and things change and time changes, and technology then creates another metaphor change as we have computers. And the metaphor changes again from arms and levers and fuel in a mechanical industrial age to, you and I ought to get together and interface sometime. We're looking for work. Why don't we network with each other? You know, it's really important that we get ourselves programmed or deprogrammed, and our metaphors about how we live and learn are shadows of a technology that teaches us those metaphors, and we see ourselves again differently, and we see even time differently. Because 9 to 5, the factory time that the factory created, isn't so important when you're a lone eagle out on a farm telecommuting, or even you're telecommuting from your home 10 miles from where it is that the headquarters of your company is. And 9 to 5 local time means nothing in a global economy, because we are connected across the world, and that changes our concept of time, our concept of family. Thought problem for a moment. What would have happened to our ancestors if they had had the tech support that we have? If they had had Google and Skype and iChat and could have supported their lives, maintaining family and language all the way around the world. Good things and bad things. Now, I'm not here to stand in judgment like some old guy saying, back when I was a kid, things were better. But there are changes that technology give us that are clear blessings. And there are changes that, in my view, are clear curses, and most of them we will not really understand in real time. We touched on this, I think, last week a little bit, because of the boundary issues. My generation's sense of privacy is completely different from my children's and grandchildren's sense of privacy. It never would have occurred to me to sext a picture of myself, even when I had a self that was in shape good enough to be sexed. I mean, my idea of privacy is very different. The intimacy of Facebook and what people tell us about themselves is, I mean, shocking to someone of my generation and not to others. It's a change, and it's a change that changes values and mores as well as behaviors. Being connected around the world. Will pictures of all of the poverty and all of the war and all of the wealth, will these lead people to outrage or desensitize us to the pain of the world? Well, the answer is clearly both. We will be connected across the world in ways that we cannot foresee. The technologies that we have, the wise predictions that pundits make, are incomplete information problems. We don't know the impact of our technology. Gutenberg couldn't know what his breakthrough would mean. The Industrial Revolution couldn't predict what would happen. My favorite bad prediction was in the 1910 New York Times, where it said that the automobile was the answer to New York's terrible pollution problem. Now, it was, because the effluent from an exhaust pipe is considerably better than the effluent from a horse. And if you had as many horses as you had cars in New York, everybody in New York would wake up dead. It's not a livable situation. But the pundit said, this is the answer. We don't know what the answers are. We know that technology is going to surprise us in all different kinds of ways. The music industry was dead 5 years ago, and the internet, everything was free. Apple said, not so fast, and decided to charge for music that people were getting for free. And the iPod changed everything. The newspaper is dead. The magazine is dead. And then somebody showed me their iPad. This is not an embedded commercial, by the way. Somebody showed me their iPad, and all of a sudden, I got it. I got the book. I got the elements turning and spinning and the rich environment of text, of video, of manipulating the data, of being able to, in real time, search out links and said, whoa, this really is a game changer. Apple may not succeed institutionally, but the technology is amazing. And the proof that we can't predict what it's going to go, where it's going to go, is my favorite example was a novel by Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer, who probably saw the future more clearly than anyone else, except maybe Arthur C. Clarke, and they agreed in a written treaty that they were the second best science fiction writers because they didn't want to fight. Isaac Asimov wrote a story of an advanced civilization of human beings where they had rapid transit, where people could live out in the countryside and connect to each other over very fast lines in holographic images. He really was a futurist. But the main point of the story, the main moment of peril, is when a transportation device breaks down in the middle of nowhere. Asimov foresaw everything except the cell phone. We all know what it's like and what a difference that makes. Just the cell phone. Take the cell phone out of here, please. Because the cell phone, again like the net, connects us to the world and disconnects us at the same time. We've all had the experience where we are doing something important and the phone rings and we go, okay. And then we're talking on the phone and then we have a call waiting. And then it's a call waiting that we have to take, and we are so connected that we lose each other sometimes in the moment. It sometimes brings people from far away close together, and people who are close together in a conversation puts a barrier in. So what will our future look like? I haven't a clue. I know that it's unpredictable. I know that the technology of our children and our grandchildren will be as unrecognizable, is as unrecognizable to me as our current technology would be for my parents and certainly for my grandparents. It is a fast-changing world, and while the classical Karl Marx issues of exploitation are certainly still with us today, the assumption, if not arrogance, that we have discovered the answer to the process of history and that it will unfold in an inevitable way, Groucho would understand, is nonsense. The future is amenable to our input. We have a responsibility to engage the technology responsibly, but to believe that every discrete device and change has predictable results, think back to Gutenberg, think back to cars, and think how computers have changed our lives and how our lives and the lives of our children will be changed by the technology that we have today and by technology that we cannot begin to imagine. As I said in the introduction of the service this morning, we are not simply passive victims drifting along in all the winds of change. We have choices. We have power. We can turn them on and turn them off. And we can try to bring our sense of values to our use of technology. and not simply be prisoners to it. But the power of technology to define us and redefine us is immense. And so we have a responsibility to try to understand, to try to choose, and to try to make accommodations with those great forces. Neither victims nor rulers, we are in a give-and-take relationship with nature, with the technology, with the fruits of our own inventiveness, and with life itself. It absolutely matters, but I think the technology in many ways forms its own kind of ownership. As you get projects that are more and more expensive, you find that you're going to have a choice between various kinds of oligarchies, Halliburtons, or government, or some combination of them, because the large projects are difficult to be kind of done at home. Right now, the example that everybody in America should be looking at is our space program. Should it be governmental, or should it be private enterprise, and is there really a distinction? But, of course, the issue of ownership, the issue of unions, the issue of labor makes a huge difference. But look how much we have shifted from production economies to service and intellectual, I use intellectual in the broadest possible sense, societies. Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right in terms of corporations. Corporations are, and again, this is an example of what I'm talking about. Corporations have become not simply legal individuals, but corporations have in some ways replaced nation states. As Gutenberg created in some ways the nation by disseminating information and the Vulgate, corporations in their international manifestations are going beyond our borders, so that when we are talking about whether it's an American car or a Japanese car or a German car with parts from all over the world and corporate headquarters and hindquarters all over the world, we don't know what is American and not. You're number four, Dennis. Well, why didn't I talk about the truly wise Marx, Harpo? Because he kept his mouth shut. That's how he proved how wise he was. No, actually, he was the most intellectual of the Marx brothers. He was a member, an informal member of the Algonquin Circle in New York. He was an incredible guy. Some of you will recognize the name Oscar Levant. Oscar Levant came to Los Angeles in the 1940s, and Harpo agreed to house him for the weekend, and Oscar stayed for 5 years until he married June, and at which point Harpo said, "It's time that you guys got your own place." Read Harpo Speaks. It's a wonderful book. Certainly don't disagree, but what you have, for example, is you have our last crisis in finance was brought about by these mega corporations, and the people who worked for them who thought that they were worth $65 million to create nothing. One of the things that's going to change, and so often we, I think, identify a real problem today and don't see the solution. I've been concerned as somebody in media for a long time with media consolidation. As newspapers bought each other up and consolidated, as the networks did the same thing, it was very scary because all of the information that we get got concentrated in very few hands. But their days are numbered. If somebody offered me an FM radio station today, what would I pay for a license? Why would I pay anything for a license when I can broadcast from my home? There's an evolution and a revolution technologically taking place, which doesn't mean we take our eyes off of where exploitation is today, but it's also taking us in directions where the selfish today are going to have to find, and they will, new ways of being selfish. And we need to try to foresee where these things are going. But I accept completely your premise. Here's the choice. If information is wealth and power, watch how the technology plays out with China. China's trying to restrict content of the Internet. Whether Internet is free or not free, in terms of dollars, the issue of if you want to be wealthy as a society, you can't stop information and content at your borders. And so China has a choice to make. Will it be part of the 21st century, or will it restrict information, therefore restrict creativity, therefore restrict their future? It's an interesting choice. We have it on the, that's a macro choice. We have it on the micro choice with how we monitor the internet and the communications and the twittering and tweeting and texting of our children. Final thing. 500 years from now, if the technology doesn't change, we will have evolved tiny little thumbs for texting.